All right. Welcome to today's Talky Bit. It's good to be back. Some of us in our family had the opportunity to see the excellent and very moving play Bastard at PTE this past week. It is the debut production of a new BIPOC theater company called Out From Under the Rug. Great name. It is still playing tonight and tomorrow. Closes Monday night, and I'm happy to suggest that if you can, it's worth getting out to see. The director is a person that that we've sort of obliquely encountered through some of our other adult kids theater work before, but hadn't seen in person in this way. A person named Matthew Paris Irvine, and as sometimes happens in a theater setting, Matthew, as a director, came out before the play started to sort of introduce the play and welcome the audience and so on. In hindsight, I think I would show up again just for the warmth, the deep thoughtfulness, and that just outright beauty of his intro. And I mean, not always the way it works, right? But like the play itself, Matthew just kind of opened up his heart and his mind, and he invited us in. And one of the ways that he did that was by talking about his own process for acknowledging where we were in that moment, that we were on the land of Treaty One, that we were on in a place that has been the longtime home of people, and not just people groups, not just big sort of easily defined or easily named, at least sort of tribes, but individual people and their lives and stories. And he talked about, and this was very remarkable to me, but he talked to standing in front of the audience. He gestured and he said, "Every night before I do this, I sit in that seat over there for 3 or 4 minutes." If you ever practice silence, you know that being deliberate about something, being mindful about something for 3 or 4 minutes is a long time. He said, "I sit in that seat every night for 3 or 4 minutes before I do this, and I think about what it means to me to say these words about where we gather." And then he told us what it meant to him. And as Taya, who was with us, said to me the next day, Matthew had many of us in tears before the play even started. It was just a beautiful, warm, "I see you, I share life with you," kind of moment. It was really incredible. It was very powerful, and it stirred a question in me, like, what's that power about? What's going on here? This is a, I wouldn't hesitate to say it was a spiritual experience. That's not the kind of question you answer in a sentence, because it's about lots of things, some visible, many not visible. But one of the visible reasons that that intro was so moving for me was because it made explicit Matthew's conviction that we, us humans, are interdependent beings. That seeing one another, deeply seeing one another, which is in no small part a significant theme in the play as well, is essential and life-giving and beautiful. And as a recurring line in the play said, everything in the universe is about love. And when it's not about love, it's about the absence of love. That central to this whole story is love. We're not meant to function alone. We don't do well when we try to live that way. And in fact, I would say that to try to live that way could fairly be said to be in violation of our core nature, our reality as humans. And yet, we live in a society that often emphasizes individuality in ways that tilt us away from interdependence. And I think there are some discernible reasons for that. I've talked about some of my opinions about that in this space before. I also believe that there are some approachable antidotes, and we'll be exploring some of that this morning. I had a short chat with someone in the people helping business the other day. It was a work conversation, but kind of in passing, we ended up talking about how complicated it is for many of us to re-engage the wider world these days. He used the phrase pandemic hangover, which stuck with me. And there are a couple of reasons I think that metaphor is still speaking to me. Personally, I'm not much of a drinker. Booze makes me sleepy, and Sleepy Tim is not my best social Tim. So thundering hangovers are not something I know much about, except as I've been, you know, told about them, or perhaps on occasion been around people who are suffering from them. But generally speaking, my understanding as well as my limited experience would suggest that when we're hungover, we feel a bit muddled. We don't feel good, that's for sure. And as somebody with a little bit of emergency medical training in my background, I know why. I get the biological reason why. But if I have a hangover, or if somebody has a hangover, they probably don't care about that information. We just feel lousy. And we might even want to go back to feeling intoxicated, at least a little bit, because our fuzzy memory tells us that that was better than this. Anyway, as somebody that grew up around Bible stories, the image that comes to mind is the part of the Hebrew Exodus narratives where this group of people who were once slaves in Egypt, they're now in the midst of what is turning out to be a much longer than anticipated, you know, escape from bondage, and they're getting short on food. So they go to their leadership team and they say, "We would rather be slaves in Egypt where we at least had food than be out here in this desert facing possible starvation." It's a bit of a devil you know versus the devil you don't story. I would rather stay intoxicated than face the headache of getting sober. Or perhaps in terms that are less about substances, I would rather stay distracted than face reality. Facing reality, really facing it and not just considering some fantasy about it, is what my colleague was talking about. Those first steps back into the harsh light of morning can be genuinely painful and difficult. And we want shortcuts. Like, yes, please. We definitely want shortcuts. Just for fun, when I was getting this ready, I Googled the very broad search criteria, hangover cures. And as anyone who spends any time on the internet knows, choosing your search criteria can, you know, definitely lead you places you didn't expect. In this case, it led me pretty much exactly where I expected, but in much higher volume than anticipated. Maybe I shouldn't have been surprised that initial search got me 1,800,000 results and a lot of other suggested search criteria, including one fairly close to the top of the queue about different cures for hangovers from different parts of the world that I thought sounded interesting. It wasn't interesting enough to me to put time into it, but if I ever had just time worth nothing to do, that's probably the link I would have followed. Now, also not surprising perhaps, was how to cure a hangover fast was right at the top of the list. I mean, of course it was. Very few of us want to feel poorly. And when we do, we're pretty motivated to make it stop. But many of us are finding that the quick fixes our society offers aren't often doing the job. And when it comes to dealing with our pandemic hangover, which is what got me down this hangover path in the first place, this invitation to kind of come out and party seems to feel maybe just a little bit like, just get back to drinking, you know, as a cure. It's interesting to me how much of getting back to normal or what's getting billed that way doesn't seem to be connecting all that well. And I'm not saying that there aren't many normal things we want to get back to. Of course there are. And there are normal things that we couldn't be more delighted about getting back to. And at the center of that, for most of the people I talk to, it's about connecting with people that we've been disconnected from, being able to be together physically with people we haven't been able to be with. But at least a few of the high-profile events, the sort of occasions that are billed as getting back to normal, have kind of tanked. They've been canceled, or they've not performed as anticipated. Some noteworthy exceptions locally would be, for example, Folk Festival, which, again, think about how that event is billed. It's about people connecting with people and about music. You know, it's not billed first of all as a party. It's billed first of all as a connection. I think that's fascinating. Maybe somewhere deep down, we've started to realize that as much as this pandemic has been and continues to be something very, very difficult, we are more, maybe we just say we're more used to our previous normal than we were enamored with it. It was normal, but that didn't mean we loved everything about it and just couldn't wait to get back to the way it was. I don't think it takes any kind of a observational wizard to see that the cracks of that normal were already showing for some, and they had been gaping chasms for a long time for many. Maybe we don't want to get back to normal at all, but having been deeply disrupted, we're more open to get on with change for the better instead. Or if not instead, then in the mix. And it's in this that sort of spirit of getting on with change for the better that I want to explore the metaphor of trees a bit this morning. I think that trees have some profound lessons to teach us about better. Lessons on the kind of level that have drawn spirit people, people connected to mystery, to reality, to the divine, for as long as records of their musings have been kept. For those that grew up in the Judeo-Christian traditions, as I did, we barely get off page one of the story before we've got a tree metaphor. And it's a doozy, standing in for huge themes like the loss of human innocence and justice and how we apply what we know about what is right and what is wrong. Not to mention the way the story touches on the way we can manipulate other people and hand off blame and so many huge themes. And for those for whom the Jesus stories are central, it's worth noting that when Jesus really wanted to make a point about human justice and the downside of not practicing it, so the consequences of living in a way that denies reality, we could say, what he did to illustrate that is he cursed a tree. He cursed a tree that was symbolic of his people group, of his tribe, and a tree that was an image of the potential for a life characterized by everyone having what they needed and being able to live and enjoy what they needed without fear. And he just was like, if you don't live in accord with reality, those things, those kinds of dreams exactly, are the things that'll die. They won't survive. I think that's fascinating in its context. In the Buddhist tradition, especially as it has been resonant with the Western world in the late 20th, early 21st centuries, images of trees and fruit have often been points of real connection. If you want to read, this is a very beautiful thing, it's well worth looking up, it's short. If you want to read a truly lovely expression of this, look up Thich Nhat Hanh's Tangerine Meditation. And if you just Google that, Thich Nhat Hanh, Tangerine Meditation, you'll find the story. It's a very, very lovely engagement with living mindfully and how that can open into authentic happiness in an act as simple as receiving, peeling, and eating a tangerine. It's really lovely. In many expressions of indigenous spirituality, creator is an intertwined reality in which the relationships between all living things, the interbeing, to use a Buddhist phrase for that same idea, is central. It's essential. It's a given. It's gravity. I could illustrate from many other traditions as well. There seems to be something deeply true, deeply real about the ways in which trees, living things, organic things, I mean, a tangerine isn't a tree, I realize. I'm drifting from my central metaphor, but that trees and things like that speak to us about the best, about the most important aspects of reality and how to live in accord with it. I want to consider a couple of those as sort of the rest of our time together today. Now, as always, my motivation personally is to offer something in this context that might be catalytic, something we can all consider and ask ourselves, what is there here that might be for me or for my community? What bag is there here that is mine to pick up and conversely not to pick up? If you're new to the table or if you're listening to this as a podcast and it's a first pass at a podcast from this context, this might be as good a time as any for me to say that the table is not generally the sort of place where you'll get told what to believe or what lifestyle codes to follow. And I know there are people for whom that is a deep and essential desire in a religious context in particular. Tell me what the right things are to believe and tell me what the right things are to do and I'll go do them. And that will feel like it stabilizes my life. And I do not wish to denigrate that, but I do wish to say, this is not that place. And just to provide a little context, I would say that the table is more like a buffet where you are invited to step up to the table, to pay attention to what you need, and then take that in the context of other people being there doing the same. So not as an isolated individual, but in an interactive or interdependent context. That's what I'm trying to offer here. So, in that spirit, something's about trees. I want to suggest, and I won't unpack these very much at all, but I want to suggest that there are four aspects of trees that can help to guide us on a joyful journey toward a normal that is better, that is healthier, that is more in accordance with what is real, then many of the metaphors that have underpinned the development of the Western mind and the Western world, I'd say since the Enlightenment, I mean, really further back than that, but certainly, you know, kind of on steroids since then. And we won't take a lot of time, like I said, to unpack these today. I'm just going to put them out there for our ongoing reflection and interaction about them if we choose that, and then we'll go from there. So I'll offer these as statements. Of course, any statement is open to question, to consideration and reconsideration. So I think these are relatively obvious, but I also want that other reality to be there. Trees are irrepressibly lush. I've talked about this before in this space, my personal perennial astonishment at the fresh green of spring. Our context in this part of the world, in southern Manitoba, in Canada, in this hemisphere, is that winter is harsh, can be long. Things turn into solid bricks of ice, including all the things that are now outside my window green. And in the spring, that changes. They thaw and they come back to life. Mind blower. On our family trip this summer, we had several occasions to hike or bike through what are called cut blocks. And those are areas in the mountains that have been logged, often with a method called clear cutting, which is pretty much what it sounds like. And now they're growing back. It's astounding to see. The air in those parts of the world is just full of the smells and the sounds of new life. If you've ever been amazed to see a flower pushing its way up through a crack in the asphalt or a tree growing out of what appears to be solid rock on a mountainside, you're looking at that same aspect of trees. Maybe we could say it's the determination to live, to reach down toward what gives life, whether that means reaching up to the sunshine or down for nourishment or, as we'll consider shortly, you know, laterally for support. Both words in that sentence, in that particular metaphor, are important: irrepressible and lush. The drive to flourish has got to be one of the most beautifully confounding things that I know about humanity. When we see it fading, we know that something isn't well. When we see leaders or organizations repressing it, we know that there are questions we should be asking about whether they are trustable or not. When we see it burgeoning under difficult circumstances, we are in awe. If we attend to it, even briefly, I believe that we can experience a connection with whatever we sense is bigger than us and know that we are in the presence of capital L life. And we can know that we too are made to be irrepressibly, lushly alive. Trees can effortlessly bend without breaking. I wrestled with the inclusion of the word effortlessly in that sentence. We had a pretty good-sized tree in our yard. It was about 14 inches, a little better than that at the base. Come down in a wind about a week ago. And it looked to me like a healthy tree. There was no signs of dead branches. I pruned it with the same sort of attention that I pay to other trees in our little forest here. There was no hollowing trunk. There were lots of green leaves. It was flourishing as far as the visible signs go. But it failed at ground level, like right at the level of the soil. And when it toppled and was uprooted, so to speak, I could see that its roots had never gone deep. And in this particular case, it was the long-ago construction of a fence that had interfered with its root formation and made it vulnerable to collapse. So maybe that sentence, "Trees can effortlessly bend without breaking," would be truer if it said deeply rooted trees. Even adequately rooted trees can effortlessly bend without breaking. We can bend without breaking as well, but deep roots are essential. So what does it mean to deepen, to strengthen our roots? And how can we do that so that when the winds of change and transition and stress and loss come, we can bend with some grace without breaking? I'm going to leave that as an open question. It's not the sort of thing that we would all answer the same, but I think there are answers for all, at least some degree of answers for all of us. Trees constantly negotiate darkness and light. Sometimes I feel like we live in a world that would like to keep us not so much in the dark as in the dim light. We're made for these cycles, for the bright moments that we might naturally associate with things like joy, as well as for the darkness of emotions like grief or loss. When we resist this reality, we tilt our lives toward a kind of emotional twilight. And I don't know if you've ever sort of consciously gone through twilight to have this experience and be aware of it, to be mindful of it. But twilight is that curious part of the day where everything loses its color. Like our eyes and brains actually stop being able to make color of what's being reflected to them. But it's still too bright to truly close our eyes and rest. It's a time of day, both literally and metaphorically, when it's hard to see clearly and not a space to stay in for an extended period of time. If you're going to hit a deer on the highway, it's most likely to be at twilight. It would be better for us, it seems to me, to let the trees remind us that it's okay to love the light and to need it, and we are also equipped for the dark. We do not need to fight the dark. Going to leave that idea there. Finally, trees exist in exquisite interdependence with the rest of the living world. I love that the science conversation that is surfacing these days in tree research is much of it's about something called the mycelial web. The mycelial web is what one writer described as trees being, quote, relational miracles, all their own, entangled in complex symbiotic webs of interbeing, constantly communicating with one another through chemical signals dispatched along the fungal networks that live in their roots, an invisible, astonishing underworld. The trees talk to one another. Much of this fascinating world has been revealed by the work of a Canadian forest ecologist named Suzanne Simard. You can easily find her work outlined in a couple of TED Talks. There's one called The Secret Life of Trees, which has been animated by a couple of her colleagues. There's another one that is her sort of speaking more directly to her research that's titled How Trees Talk to Each Other. Arguably, this is another instance of science using its particular tools and perspectives to demonstrate what the ancient sages already knew or sensed. When trees need something, they are part of a network, invisible most of the time, but both real and essential, through which they can ask for what they need and get it. And the poets have been talking to us about how this living relationship between trees and the things around them, like streams of living water. That's the same way that our spirits thrive. And the poets have been telling us this. The spirit people have been telling us this for millennia. This is how it works. Maybe that metaphor is still speaking to us because we still have lessons to learn from it. Isolated people, when we live as isolated people, we are vulnerable people. And whether you're someone that would identify with this idea or not, I think one of the possible strengths of the Christian notion that God is three yet one is akin to this. The constant, unhindered interdependence of that metaphor for the divine and the life of the divine as reflected in us as creation, as bearing that same sort of image, I think that's a pretty beautiful metaphor for this. That's an articulation of both an ideal and an observable reality, which is that life, all life, is meant to be interdependent. And when we assail that, we weaken something essential. I'm going to leave it there for today. And I'm going to give the last word to someone whose thought and work was deeply committed to helping us understand our connection to one another. Over a century ago, we've talked about this person's work in the space before. William James offered the then radical idea that, quote, we experience what we agree to attend to. We experience what we agree to attend to. In our exploring of what we believe, which is what this community says we're here to do, maybe it's maybe it's time to attend to the trees. As always, you will decide. But I want to encourage you in your life today, when you see something that is irrepressibly alive and lush and green, something that is growing, to stop for just a moment and attend to it and see if it has something to teach you and to teach us about what it means to tilt our lives toward life.